Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
The Honorable Arthur Carroll presiding.
Ready. This is case number 2018-CA-5321, starting with the plaintiffs. Let's take appearances, please.
Good morning. Samantha Lawrence on behalf of the Kowalskis with assistance from Greg Anderson, Nick Whitney, and Jennifer Anderson.
Ms. Lawrence, good morning.
Howard Hunter, Your Honor, with Pat Crowell's, Ethan Shapiro, and David Hughes, and Chris Altenburn for Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. Our corporate representative today is Dr. Michelle Smith.
Morning. I'm trying to see if Mr. Altenburn's here. Mr. Hughes is blocking him.
I'm here. I'm sorry, Your Honor, but preliminary matter, we have, I don't want to ignore the doctor in the room. Dr. Kirkpatrick is here. We have him under subpoena. We left a message with his office on Friday, which he acknowledged he got, that said he did not need to appear this morning. And he's here in the courtroom. And we've advised him we don't need him today. We told him on Friday not to come, but he's here. He's not released from his subpoena, so he can't stay in the courtroom. Not sure why he's here, sir, but I wanted to address the issue.
Is he, I'm trying to figure out where he is in the expert, treating expert, panoply of experts.
I think the ruling from the court's been clear that if you're a treater, you don't get to, that the thing's been, that the rule's been invoked. If you're an expert, retained expert, it's not.
Well, I thought the court had made a ruling as to Dr. Kirkpatrick in particular that he was going to be deemed an expert as opposed to a treating physician. Mm-hmm. But if I'm wrong, I'll tell him.
Well, I think Dr. Kirkpatrick as a treating physician needs to be outside if he were to be here all day for not being called as a witness. I mean, I don't know if what's going on there.
We are not calling him as a witness today. We told him that on Friday, his office. We are not releasing him from his subpoena. Depending on where the trial goes and what evidence is in, we may or may not call him.
It's fine, Pat. Doctor, you're going to have to step out.
Yeah. I want to begin today, or I guess our next issue today, since we already had a first issue, is to pick up where we were discussing at the end of the day on Friday, which I thought was a very illuminating discussion, but certainly Mr. Anderson and Mr. Hunter weren't in the room. I'm hoping each side has had an opportunity to discuss amongst the individual teams and hopefully with each other the issue that were discussed, i.e., whether there was going to be a claim for damages associated with Munchausen by proxy from the plaintiffs, and whether the defense had some further statement or clarification as to whether it was contending or not contending then. So, who's going to lead us off in this little discussion?
Since I was on the spot on Friday, I will. We filed last night a memorandum in response. I have a paper copy here for the court.
Is this the one about basically moving to conform the pleadings if we start talking about Munchausen by proxy?
As alternative relief, yes, Your Honor.
So I have read that one.
Okay, well then, I'll be succinct. Our position is we are not currently seeking damages for the diagnosis or mere suspicion of Munchausen by proxy. We attempted to do so. That claim was brought for Beata Kowalski in our count 17 for medical malpractice. The defense filed a motion for summary judgment. They prevailed, arguing that they had made no such diagnosis. She was never a patient. Their licensure prevents them from treating or evaluating people older than 22, and that Munchausen by proxy, if it appeared in the records, was a mere suspicion. So for all those reasons, we are not and have not sought damages in this case for Munchausen by proxy. None of our psychiatric experts testified to the anything relevant to Munchausen by proxy, the diagnostic criteria, anything of the sort. So we object to the admission of evidence at this point of Munchausen by proxy or documents aimed at shoring up suspicions of Munchausen by proxy. If the defense prevails on this argument, then we do move to reassert count 17 and move forward with a medical malpractice claim for Beata Kowalski.
Please, the court, I'll take these in order if you wish. The first thing I heard was a question of our position with respect to the question of whether there is CRPS here. I'll address that first. Our position is and has been that Maya Kowalski does not have CRPS, that she has a psychogenic disorder of some sort, and that is what we suspected at the time of hospitalization, and that is what we had charted throughout the hospitalization. Throughout the hospitalization, however, we never ruled out CRPS. It cannot be definitively ruled out. As a matter of fact, I'm sure you'll hear one of our experts cross-examine tomorrow with an observation in his report that while he does not believe that she had CRPS, it cannot be definitively ruled out, or at least reasonable minds can differ with respect to that. The point here is, however, and has been, that the treatment rendered for the purported CRPS was inappropriate. That was suspected at the time of hospitalization, and that is our position to this day. The point here is that this patient had a pain syndrome of some sort, and whether it was CRPS or whether she was a victim of Munchausen by proxy and or had conversion disorder or some other psychogenic pain syndrome, the point remains that the treatment for those conditions is the same. The standard of care treatment for those conditions is the same. Whether it's CRPS, a pain syndrome associated with Munchausen's, or conversion disorder, or some derivation of the two or three, the treatment is all the same. That's where we are coming from. That's where we've been. Now, as far as the Munchausen's by proxy is concerned, I would direct Your Honor's attention to what plaintiffs have indicated is the 8th amended complaint. In paragraphs 27 and 28, there is an express allegation that we were remiss in diagnosing Maya with a variety of psychiatric conditions and alleging that none of them were treated. There's also an allegation that with reference to Munchausen by proxy in that same paragraph, and another in paragraph 130. In opening statement, counsel indicated that the plaintiffs were going to prove that the allegations that Beata Kowalski was trying to harm her children, both Kyle and MK, caused her in the end to, quote, lose control of the maternal instinct and resulted in suicide, unquote. There are multiple other references in opening statement to the same type of allegation. The allegation that Beata was wrongfully accused of Munchausen's or of attempting to harm her children or taking inappropriate care of her children goes to the heart of plaintiff's allegations of intentional infliction of emotional distress. The point that is being made throughout here, we think, by the plaintiffs, is that these allegations against the defense, against the defendant, are the soul of the case. They can't run from that, Your Honor. And preventing us at this point from proving up, as we intend to do today and tomorrow, that Munchausen's was a reasonable suspicion, if not the correct diagnosis, goes to the heart of the defense.
But that diagnosis goes to Mom and not to Maya.
That is correct, Your Honor, but it's material to Maya for this reason. Munchausen by proxy may well be and probably is an adult diagnosis. It's a diagnosis of the perpetrator. But we have to treat the victim. Maya has Munchausen by proxy. The point is that she's a victim of Munchausen by proxy and or a conversion disorder that is associated with it. That was what was thought at the time. That is what we think today. The question of whether there is a diagnosis of Maya personally, her individually, with Munchausen by proxy is a red herring. The point is that syndrome, we believe there was reasonable cause to suspect and conclude existed, and that it was influencing what was happening and being exhibited in behavior by Maya. That's the point.
And what were the specific allegations in the Eighth Amendment complaint that you referenced?
In paragraph 128, let me make sure I get them all here, Chip. While Maya, under paragraph 128, while Maya was under its care, JHACH failed to develop a coherent treatment plan for Maya, with its doctors and staff consistently denying Maya's CRPS diagnosis and instead diagnosing Maya with a variety of psychiatric conditions, none of which were treated. Even when advised by pain physicians at other medical institutions that JHACH's approach and diagnosis were inconsistent and mutually exclusive, JHACH failed to correct its approach to Maya's care. In early January, as JHACH was hell-bent on painting Maya as a psychiatric patient while still maintaining to the dependency court that she was a victim of Munchausen by proxy, a physician at Kennedy Krieger grew frustrated with the management team and physicians during a call and advised that, quote, Munchausen and conversion are competing disorders and JHACH needs to pick one. That this did not occur to JHACH as they persisted in their unsound approach is a breach of the highest order. Now that...
So I asked what paragraph site. Can you just tell me what paragraph...
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. That's paragraph 128 I just read. Sorry.
Okay. No worries. I just want to know so I can go back and read for myself.
Okay. Sorry.
So just tell me whatever specific allegations that you want me to look at.
And you might also consult paragraph 129 and 130, as well as paragraph 131 and 132. Now, that's in the operative Eighth Amendment complaint. If you refer to the opening statement, you will see the passage that I just referred to, as well as a number of others. We did a word search over the weekend of the plaintiff's transcripts that we have thus far, not all of them. We see 64 references to Munchausen's by proxy in the plaintiff's case. The idea, the central point of the overarching allegations, as I understand them to be, and as the defense has developed its case, are essentially twofold. Number one, there is an allegation that we failed to appreciate and honor, if you will, a diagnosis of CRPS that this patient had received from essentially two, if not three, outpatient physicians. We were alleged to have been
negligent in not recognizing that diagnosis, accepting that diagnosis, and continuing the care of that diagnosis as had been outlined by Drs. Kirkpatrick, Cantu, and Hanna, which that we believed to have been destructive and dangerous. But the allegation is that we failed to proceed with treating her in accordance with that diagnosis and that treatment plan. The secondary allegation is that instead of doing that, we suspected a psychogenic component to her presentation. We suspected a psychogenic component to the way in which she was presenting her pain syndrome, as did, by our count, approximately 40 other physicians at two other institutions, at Lurie Children's and Tampa General, that we suspected that there was Munchausen's by proxy and or conversion disorder and or factitious disorder, depending upon which of those you subscribe to. And there's a good deal of controversy about them that Your Honor is about to hear a good bit more about. But the point is that the soul of their allegation against us is that we suspected the psychogenic constellation of presentation symptoms, and that that was a deviation from the standard of care in the way we pursued that and allegedly failed to properly treat it.
Let me attempt to articulate some thoughts I had that I've been spending over the weekend trying to coalesce into something hopefully articulable. Assume for the sake of argument, Mom had Munchausen or whatever of those terms you wish to apply. So just assume that to be true. Does that change anything with respect to how the hospital should be treating its patient, who is not the mom, but mine? And I just as, let me back up, the question of whether Mom has Munchausen to me sounds like something that would have been front and center in the dependency court on the medical neglect, medical abuse case. In the dependency court, of course, that we're not trying the Chapter 39 aspect in this case. Just like the jury knows that DCF was involved and there was a dependency court, it knows that the position of Johns Hopkins, All Children's Hospital, was that Mom had this. But in this lawsuit, do we need to prove whether Mom had it or not? And that's what I continue to struggle with, because it doesn't seem to me that it really goes to your medical malpractice case. And I was thinking over the weekend, like, well, does it go to your defense of the intentional infliction of emotional distress count? And obviously, I think the concept that you believed that to be the case, that Mom did have it, I think is relevant. But at what point do we need to keep going on and on and on and trying to prove Mom has Munchausen? Because even if that's true, how does that change what was done or not done to Maya in this case? Now, I think you've got some traction with me in the intentional infliction count, but I just, what started all of this is a whole series of emails and possible blogs about what was going on with Maya that doesn't seem to have anything to do with medical malpractice, but perhaps it does with intentional infliction. That's kind of the dichotomy. So if you'd like to comment on my rumblings there, I'll give you a chance. Because ultimately I need to make decisions on admission of evidence.
I understand, Judge. I'm kind of flabbergasted.
Can I make one comment as a person who understands the DCF part of this?
Well, once I do that, Mr. Altenburn, then I'm opening up, and I was trying to keep us more focused on proceeding forward. Mr. Hunter.
Let me start by noting that based upon Your Honor's rulings, this is not just a medical malpractice case. A lot of it is a medical malpractice case, no question. But it's a battery case, it's a false imprisonment case, it's a negligent infliction of emotional distress case, it's an intentional infliction of emotional distress case. Over and over and over again, we have heard from the plaintiffs, this evidence sponsored, that evidence admitted on the basis that it went to the plaintiff's or the decedent's state of mind. The decedent's state of mind is what caused, allegedly, her to commit suicide. Her state of mind was created, allegedly, by what? By her daughter's disease? Probably. But the allegation against us is that we created her state of mind. And we created her state of mind by doing as was suggested in opening, and that is that we were suggesting that her actions and her approach to her child's disease was harming the child. We're accused, they, that includes we, and there's been confabulation about that, we, are accused of separating the child from the mother. Why? Because of the allegation that the mother was doing harm to her child. That allegation is based around Munchausen by proxy. The defense of this case, with all respect, Your Honor, whether it's malpractice, whether it's false imprisonment, whether it's any of these things, all of the defense of this case rests upon the proposition that the pattern and practice of therapeutic and maternal behavior here was dangerous and inappropriate to this child. And that is why reports were made. And that is why suspicions were hatched. And that is why we attempted to act as we did with respect to the discharge of the child or the lack thereof, and the circumstances under which we attempted to treat her and to transfer her elsewhere for more treatment in accordance with the standard of care. But we cannot defend our case, Your Honor, without the idea being a centerpiece that it was reasonable for us to suspect that there was a Munchausen by proxy or a factitious disorder by proxy going on here, and that we were reasonable in suspecting that, and that we were reasonable in acting upon that as we did, and attempting to treat this patient as we did. That is central to the defense of the case. If you emasculate that, you have emasculated our defense. And I don't know what I can tell you beyond that. What you're going to hear today is from a witness who months before we ever saw this patient suspected the same thing. We believe that to be directly relevant to what we did, what we suspected, and how we did it. You're going to hear from our treating physician, Dr. Elliott, one of our employees, about what he encountered, how he responded, what he did. You're going to hear from an expert tomorrow that will pull all of this together, we hope. But I have to tell you, Your Honor, this is inimical and central to what they've alleged against us, and to our defense against it.
Let me hear from Mr. Whitney, and I will tell you what I'm hearing about, at least with respect to the intentional infliction of emotional distress count, that there may be some
need for the some of the evidence that was being discussed on Friday afternoon. So, Mr. Whitney, let me hear from you, and then we'll move on.
Well, I'll start there with the intentional infliction of emotional distress. The contours of the hospital's conduct and Mr. Walski's conduct and what was not allowable and what was allowable with respect to their visitation or their supervision all goes to Chapter 39. So what we've brought forward on intentional infliction are things that have nothing to do with Munchausen by proxy. Catherine Beatty sitting in on phone calls. Catherine Beatty telling Jack to divorce his wife. Catherine Beatty saying that she's going to adopt Maya and be her mother. None of these things have to do with Munchausen by proxy. Listening to Mr. Hunter, the phrases that he uses give away that the Munchausen by proxy is wedded to Chapter 39 proceedings. He talks about justifying the separation. Justifying the separation is what they were doing in the dependency court. And those orders are separated the mother and child, but there's no need to justify the separation unless we're going to relitigate the Chapter 39 proceeding. He talks about suspicions. He talks about reports, hotline reports. These all go straight to Chapter 39. Even the allegations he points to in our medical malpractice claim in paragraph 128, Munchausen and conversion are competing disorders. When we tried to introduce that note out of the risk management file, it was excluded because it was central to Chapter 39. In paragraph 130, the mention of Nurse Ashley stating that Maya exhibited textbook Munchausen. Yes, that's in our claim, but the court's been drawing lines, and one of the lines it's drawn is that the hotline reports are out. Nurse Ashley's characterization as textbook Munchausen is in the first or the second hotline call. That's not part of this case. Even if the defense was allowed to put in all of this evidence, they can't close the loop. They have no expert on causation. They have no expert on it. They don't have an adult psychiatrist. They would need an adult psychiatrist. There's no dispute about this. The DSM-5 says the perpetrator receives this diagnosis. It's the adult. They would need an adult psychiatrist to come in here to close the loop. The context of 64 references to Munchausen by proxy in our case. There's no specific citation, and I did not review the transcripts that they have. But the court will call the Munchausen by proxy term is what was thrown around in that transfer diagnosis to Nemours in the midst of the dependency. So I'm willing to wager that 95% plus of those references to Munchausen by proxy are specific discussions around that transfer diagnosis and the reasons that Jack and Bia declined transfer under those circumstances. Nothing about our experts getting on the stand and making arguments or opinions about whether Munchausen by proxy was or was not the appropriate diagnosis. And lastly, on the psychogenic constellation of Maya Kowalski, the psychogenic constellation of diagnoses of Maya Kowalski does not include Munchausen by proxy. It cannot. The psychogenic constellation of Maya Kowalski has to do with what their psychologist diagnosed, Dr. Katzenstein, who I think we hear from today, psychological factors affecting other medical conditions. That's the DSM-5 diagnosis of Maya Kowalski, confirming that she has CRPS, but she has a psychogenic overlay on that. The other diagnoses they entertained for Maya Kowalski in this psychogenic constellation are factitious disorder, not factitious disorder imposed on another, but factitious disorder of Maya Kowalski and conversion disorder. So there are at least three diagnoses of Maya Kowalski that they threw around that compose this psychogenic constellation. None of them are Munchausen by proxy. They go specifically to Beata. So again, if Mr. Hunter's argument persuades this court, we move to reassert count 17, because now they're claiming they did make a diagnosis of Munchausen by proxy. They want to argue all about it, and so we want Beata Kowalski's medical malpractice claim back.
Are there other issues, because it's getting close to 9 o'clock, other issues that we have to address before we bring in this jury?
I don't believe so, Judge. I just point out that as counsel just made reference to,
an inimical point of the false imprisonment claim is the fact that there was a transfer offered, there was a transfer that was put together, you're going to hear more about it tomorrow morning, and it was refused. Why was it refused? Because of that diagnosis. Because of the diagnosis, because to almost directly quote, we would be admitting to Munchausen by proxy to child abuse if we signed off on those transfer papers. They put this in the case from day one, Judge, and they can't run from it now.
Okay. How does you proving that Maya did or did not have it change Beata's state of mind as to her decision not to sign the transfers concerning or when there was any sort of possible reference? And I think, though, that came later as opposed to the October date.
Yes, correct.
So, you know, let's try not to conflate those. I'm having enough trouble keeping those two apart in my mind myself. But, you know, I feel like I've clipped the plaintiff's wings very hard on trying to keep Chapter 39 out. And it just seems that now that I've done that, the defense wants to make this case in trying to prove that Beata had Munchausen, which seems to be the heart of what was going to be in the dependency court, which is what I was not letting in the plaintiff's case in chief.
With all respect, Your Honor, you have ruled on the Chapter 39, and to be honest with you, I have yet to understand where the dividing line is on this. But what I do know is this. What I do know is that the remaining case against us, whether it's the false imprisonment or the intentional infliction or the negligent infliction of the malpractice, is all bound up in how in what we suspected and what we did and how we ruled on it and the impact of that on Mrs. Kowalski's state of mind and on her conduct. If Your Honor tries to carve that out of this case, it eviscerates a major portion of the defense and puts us in a completely untenable position. I would suggest to the court that Mr. Whitney's argument is for the jury. It's not for admissibility. And I would urge Your Honor to let this go forward and let us try our case.
Are there other issues that we have to address prior to the jury coming in?
Well, Judge, the first witness is on this issue.
On Beata's, whether she has?
No, Judge, the first witness is Dr. Elvin Mendez of Fort Myers. Dr. Mendez saw this patient in October of 2015 and December of 2015. He was consulted regarding immunotherapy. And after two visits with this patient, he indicated in one of his conclusions that Munchausen by proxy should be considered, and he advised Dr. Wasenauer of that fact in a copy of a letter to him. The point of his testimony is exactly this, and the point of his testimony is, you know, frankly, a point I thought I tried to make in opening, and that is that we stumbled upon this trail and followed it. It was not a new trail.
Mr. Altenberg.
Two completely unrelated things. I'm only here for a little while, hopefully, to find out, A, if you've looked at the instruction that you're contemplating on the visitation at all, because Mr. Elegant and I need to kind of get closure on that, because by Wednesday we really need to have had that instruction read. The other thing I was waiting to see was how many counts were going to be gone or not on direct verdict, so I can finish the jury instructions.
Well, I don't have time to address that right now. Hopefully, after lunch, we can close the loop on some or all of the DV motions. So I don't know if you want to hang out until after lunch to see.
I've got a room I can type in all my box.
And Mr. Whitney, anything else?
Well, two things. On Beata's state of mind, and the relevance, the state of mind of Beata Kowalski that's at issue in this case is the irresistible impulse, effectively. And I would point the court back to their motion for summary judgment, again, on count 17 at Den 1933, in which they made a big point of pointing out that she was admitted to Sarasota Memorial Hospital the day of the dependency proceeding when she fainted in court, and that at that time she denied ideation, and that as of that date she did not have ideation. So her state of mind deteriorated over those next 3 months, irrelevant and irrespective of what Dr. Mendez may have thought in October of 2015. I think we need to argue this Dr. Mendez issue.
Well, I think with Dr. Mendez, I'm going to be consistent with what I did with the prior treaters that saw Maya prior to the admission to Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital and kind of let that type of testimony in, because it does set the stage as to how Maya presented at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital in October of 2016. So I think the historical stuff, at least I'm going to continue to rule like I did with Lurie's doctor and the Tampa General Hospital doctor. I'm just going to stay consistent. If I'm going to change how I'm doing something, I'll let you know. But for now, I'm going to remain consistent as to how I ruled with respect to those two hospital visits.
May I make a record on that?
Sure.
Well, we believe, again, this is Chapter 39, Issue 403, and irrelevant to the claims in this case. I'll point out again, at the time Maya Kowalski was hospitalized at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital during the false imprisonment first week, they did not have any knowledge of Dr. Mendez's records.
I don't think it's going to false imprisonment. I mean, I know it's been banning about, but I don't see how it goes to false imprisonment. I am, frankly, the only place it really seems that it possibly fits is the intentional infliction count. I still don't understand how it would fit with medical malpractice with respect to Maya.
All right.
But, I mean, I do think, and I do have some belief, it does go to the defense of your IIED count.
Understood. We disagree, but we understand.
Are we ready to bring in the jury? Let's bring in the jury. Hey, welcome everybody. How are we doing on a Monday morning?
Great.
Glad to hear it. And were the best birthday festivities fun?
Yes, thank you very much.
I want to confirm, while you were away over the weekend, you did not discuss this case amongst yourselves, you did no investigation, and you received no information. Is that all correct? And since you were last with us, has anyone seen any news accounts of this proceeding? And has anyone approached you about this case since we were last together? Mr. Hunter, your next witness, please.
May it please the court the honor. The defense calls Dr. Elvin Mendez.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth? I do.
All right, right this way, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Would you tell us your name, please?
Elvin Mendez.
And what is your occupation, Doc?
I'm currently a physician with Lee Health in Lee County and Charlotte County.
Okay. And where is your practice?
We have two locations, one in the Port Charlotte area and the second in Cape Coral.
Okay. And what is your specialty, sir?
Allergy immunology.
Would you give the jury the benefit of your background and training and education starting with undergraduate school?
I trained as they call the foreign medical graduate, so we do undergrad and med school in one 7.5 year stretch. So this was done in the Dominican Republic. I came to the U.S., trained in pediatrics in Long Island, and then moved on to Einstein and did allergy immunology. After that, I joined private practice for 4 years, joined the non-for-profit for another four, and then we headed south to Fort Myers. We've been in Fort Myers now, Charlotte County for about 21 years now, and joined Lee Health in 2015.
Okay. And I'm sorry, Dr. Amos, where did you do your residency?
In Albert Einstein College of Medicine, New York.
In New York City?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'm sorry, that was my fellowship. My residency was done at NASA University Medical Center in Long Island, New York.
So you did both your residency and your fellowship training in New York?
New York, yes.
Okay, great New York. And what are you board certified in, sir?
I was board certified in both allergy immunology and pediatrics. After years of allergy immunology, I decided to give up my board certification in pediatrics. For no particular reason, I just continued doing allergy immunology through the last 20 years.
Okay. And could you tell us what allergy and immunology entails?
From an allergy standpoint, it's we deal with a variety of different organ systems that have an allergic or immune mechanism involved. So, for example, make it easier, head to toe, sinus disease, nasal symptoms, sneezing, congestion. That's the one that we see most commonly in the offices. We also deal with skin disorders, but they have to be specific allergic skin disorders. From the lower airways, in other words, further down, then we deal with asthma and asthma-like symptoms. There are some occupational lung diseases that we may deal with when you're exposed to certain chemicals. And certainly there are other organs that are involved specifically with allergy, for example, GI or gastrointestinal system. There's a variety of not only food allergies, but also diseases that are associated with that. That's the bulk of the allergic side. The immunologic side is a little more complex. There are mechanisms that we deal with that encompass both the allergic and the immune world. It's not just immune deficiencies. There are a lot of overlaps with rheumatology, so there's some autoimmunity that we may deal with. Certainly, you know, gets to a point where we then end up referring to rheumatology. So immunologically, it's predominantly immune deficiencies that we deal with in pediatric and adults. Bless you, sir. From a allergic standpoint, there's often an overlap between one and the other, because some individuals with immune problems may present with what appear to be allergic problems. Okay. But it's one same field.
Okay. And does it also deal with immunodeficiencies?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Has there come a point in your practice with Lee Memorial Health System that you became involved with the care of Maya Kowalski?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And when did that take place, sir?
I saw her twice. The first time was in October 28th, 2015.
Okay. And do you have your notes with you, sir?
It's in my head. Yes. Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, if for the record, that is Defense Exhibit 3031, and it starts with 002. So if you want to put that up, I believe that's in evidence. And if you need to refer to that to your records, if you'll let us know, we can scroll down through.
Absolutely.
But for now, could you tell the jury what how it was that the Kowalskis came to see you in your practice?
The original visit on the schedule was for a second opinion for immune deficiency.
Okay.
Do you want me to dwell on that? Or?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So this is my just looking for a date here because we saw her twice. So this was our first visit, and there was a different reason for the second visit, but and we'll get to that later, I'm assuming. But for the first visit, it was on schedule as a second opinion for immunodeficiency.
Okay. And what was your understanding of where the patient had already been with respect to immune deficiency questions?
I'm sorry, could you elaborate on that question? More specific.
Well, you asked for a second opinion, and I'm trying to find out who the first opinion was, I guess.
So when you call our offices, we're going to want to know why you want to see us. Someone offered that information to our staff. That's all that was on our schedule. It actually says second opinion for immunodeficiency.
Okay.
The idea is that they're coming to see me because they are perceiving they may have a problem with immunity.
Okay. So when did you take a history from this patient, and was she accompanied by her mother?
I'm sorry, was?
Was she accompanied by her mother?
Yes, just her and her mother, yes.
Okay. And did you take a history from her?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and what did you find out from the history?
Overall?
Yes.
Complex. There were a lot of things going on.
Okay. Generally speaking, what history did you get from them?
You want me to be specific, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so we cover quite a bit. Just because someone comes in with a concern about immunodeficiency, there's a lot of questions I ask because, like I said earlier, immunology and allergy do kind of overlap. So you'll see in the notes, or perhaps I don't know if it's been discussed before, that there are questions that don't seem to even correlate with what they originally came in for, but there are reasons why we do that. So to answer your question, we covered quite a bit of organ systems, so that's a review system we do and we cover, and if there's anything striking within that review system, we will dwell on that particular problem. So she did all the talking. She was a great historian, I gotta say. She was very bright, so it was easy. I hate to tell you, in immunology, it's not an easy thing, but she was really good. So I was able to obtain the history on her part with regards to, because I did ask why a second opinion, and she said she wanted information on her daughter's immunodeficiency. Unfortunately, I had nothing at the time, just her history. So I had to request records.
And did you conduct an examination of the patient that day?
Yes, sir.
And what did you find, if anything?
So two things. The first thing that was striking was that she appeared to be in pain and a lot of discomfort. She was wheelchair bound, by the way, in my office. And I remember her very well because she was sitting literally next to me. And the mother was just facing me here. And she appeared to be in pain. And the only way I can say this is because she was kind of moving around on the wheelchair and some sounds were made as if she's in pain. So, but I was able to examine her. I did not elicit additional pain. I do recall that because I'm very cautious about pain. I did not perceive or rather induce any additional discomfort during the examination.
Okay. Did you find out in the course of all this what other immunologists or allergists she had seen?
Yes. So at some point during the history taking, it appeared that she had already seen actually two additional allergists.
Okay. And did you get any understanding of why it was or how it was she had come to see you?
No, sir. Her answer to me, and again, this is recollection from my notes, not recollections that I, because this was about 8 years ago, was that she was just seeking an answer to her daughter's immunodeficiency.
Okay. So at the end, well, did your examination include an examination of the skin?
Yes, sir.
Did you find anything unusual or untoward?
No, sir, that I can recollect, no.
Okay. And what, at the end of your first consultation with this patient in October of 2015, what was your plan? What was the follow-up, if anything?
Several things, because there was a lot. It wasn't just immune concerns, so obviously I needed those records from the other allergists she had seen before. There was also, so when we look at an immune deficiency, we want to determine if we can figure out what the cause is. You know, is this something that she's had since she was born? Is this something that she has acquired since she was born? So we need to inquire about things that may induce what we call a secondary immune deficiency. So other medications that she's been on. So we requested records from other physicians that had seen her at the time. So I have a sense of whether this was induced by other things that may have been given to her. What was striking in her history is that she had been through numerous ER visits, numerous physician visits, and a lot of steroids. And that's, you know, to an immunologist, that's striking, because steroids are a double-edged sword. They solve a lot of problems, but they also can induce a lot of problems. So I wanted to make sure that this was in secondary to medications. So to answer your question, it wasn't just focusing on immunity and getting records from the allergies she had seen in the past, but also perhaps some of the other areas that she visited that may provide me some information and some insight, especially lab work.
Okay. Now, when you took a history from this patient, did you get any indication that she had been in Tampa General Hospital for about 4 weeks?
No, sir.
Did you get any indication that she had been seen and worked up at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago?
More live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.